Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for the Beyond the Mekong series, which is broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Chris Catto-Smith, who is well known in many circles around Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands. Chris began his career in logistics with the RAAF in the Australian Air Force. He moved into supply chains with supermarkets, and it is incredibly important, especially since the COVID pandemic, which disrupted supply chains, and now there are still many, many issues confronting Asian governments in terms of getting goods to market. But where Chris's specialties have really come to the fore is getting supplies and what's needed out to impoverished villages and isolated islands. That's his specialty. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Luke. That's a real pleasure to meet up again with you.
Yeah, I think last time was in Bangkok. Today we're in Melbourne. Yeah. And you've made a real career out of logistics and supply chains. Could you just give us a brief outline for the audience what that means? And also, it's well known that they broke down during COVID and there's always been a struggle getting it back up. What is the situation like in terms of the broader economies?
Well, I'll just go back to an overview of logistics and supply chain. And yeah. I had a wonderful career in the Australian Air Force doing logistics. And logistics is really the art of organising goods and material, people, knowledge and information from where it's needed to where it's from where it comes from different sources. And it's a common feature across all industries. All industries have supply chains, and that means moving goods from raw material stage through to various stages of production, finished goods to markets and or where they're needed. In the military, it's the backbone of any military organisation, as we know. But I moved into Asia up to 30 years ago after a career in the Australian Air Force, and that served me quite well. I really had a brilliant time there and picked up some fantastic experiences, but it really equipped me very well to going into a never-ending field of opportunities in Asia, and originally starting in Singapore, where everything was quite, it had the foundations. Singapore is a highly organized country, but I found that I was able to provide innovation projects that added much more capability to those foundations. I moved up to Bangkok at the beginning of the year 2000 and went independent as a my own company, my own business, and I became involved in numerous projects throughout the region. Anything from industrial organizations, large retailers, as you mentioned before, manufacturing, and all of them required infrastructure and capability development in regards to their sourcing, their manufacturing, their distribution and consumption. And we use the word supply chain if we call logistics as the physical component. That's the trucks and the handling and the packaging and the storage. Supply chain is one level above that, and that's where businesses need to source internationally or locally and arrange for their products to go to an end customer. So it's a much more end-to-end view. I'll just rapidly progress to where I think you'd like this interview to go, and that's in the most recent work that's of prominence, and I had the fortune to spend many years in living in Bangkok, but many years working in Southeast Asian countries, predominantly Vietnam for about 12 years. Worked in Mindanao, the Philippines.
Yep.
I spent nearly 5 years working in and out of China, 2 years in Shanghai, 2 years in Beijing, and a year in Hohhot, Inner Mongolia. Working on logistics projects.
Right.
And China at that time had no retail capability. And we set up the first modern trade retail distribution center in China that took a delivery of a cartonized product on a pallet. That was my first project in China. That was my first with
What was in the cartons? Bottles of whiskey?
It was just consumer goods. Everything was delivered direct to store from suppliers in those days. But we set up the first retail distribution center in China, retail warehouse in China, and also the first fresh distribution center in China servicing a modern trade retailer.
Okay.
Now, China is the world's leading retail organization, surpassed the US
right,
as far as its retail infrastructure is concerned. So we've seen a rapid development there. Predominantly, although living in Thailand, I've done quite a numerous series of projects for retailers, for manufacturers, for food manufacturers. But then I found a huge opportunity with fresh produce.
Mm-hmm.
And in my last 2 years working in large retailers, I found myself increasingly drawn to the need to support the agricultural supply chains.
Right.
And on the retail side, I could see that the retailers had huge influence over the farmers, and they were not getting a just or fair treatment for the work that they were undertaking, and that there could be some massive improvements by going out of the retailer and working upstream.
And this is where your NGO work comes into play?
It's not so much NGO work. I call it corporate social responsibility.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. NGOs are organisations. CSR is something that I do as part of my business philosophy.
But I also think CSR becoming more common and more prominent these days.
Yes.
NGOs are sort of very much a byproduct of the post-Cold War era.
Pretty well,
and now it's evolving into something else.
Yeah, and I'm working with NGOs, which I'll talk about there, but I found myself just drawn to the opportunities, and I set up various agricultural projects because I had freedom, and I was trying to develop cold chain.
Right.
It was a significant amount of food loss going on everywhere.
Cold chain being...
temperature-controlled logistics, right? And the amount of food loss going that was being created by poor handling, lack of temperature control, was enormous. And it was 40% or 35% of produce was getting lost.
Going off in value, going off to market.
Being lost in value. And I felt drawn into that area that I could make a difference. And the initial project work that I did was with the Thai agricultural supply chains, and to look at the organic and high-end value products out of the northwest Thailand, Chiang Mai, Mae Sot. You'd know all of those areas along
those
the
areas
border, yeah, Mae Sot, Mae Rim. And I was seeing in the retailers, particularly in the hospitality industries, very low quality of produce. Mm-hmm. And this produce was coming from those areas that were trying to substitute the old opium manufacturers. I worked with those. And a lot of those agricultural growers were sponsored by foundations, very strong foundation support through the Buddhist foundations and the faith-based organizations, and also the King's Project. The King's Project was...
Vajira Longkorn?
Yeah, well, yes.
Oh,
No.
Bhumibol.
The previous one. And unfortunately, these incredibly well-intended projects, all of the value that was being created was being lost in the 24 hours where produce was being taken out of the mountain areas in the backs of pickup trucks, in plastic bags, in the sun. Temperature was destroying the product
and
in
24
hours.
And those losses are incurred by the farmer?
Well, yes, because usually it's the it's all CNF. The farmer gets paid what the wholesale market gives them, and when the product arrives in bad condition, it's not their fault. But everyone's trying to reduce costs.
Trying to understand some of the reasons why they get paid so little,
and they were really getting de-incentivized.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly on the organic side, where there was a huge demand, it's much more complex because it's not only temperature controlled logistics you have to have. Programs that whole areas have to comply with chemical controls, to be classified as chemical free. And in those areas where the old opium poppies were, they didn't spray and they were perfect for organics.
Mm-hmm.
But you get one farmer spraying upwind and he can destroy the whole certification project in his area. Anyway, we're able to go further downstream, and I then was approached by Tesco, British Airways, and at a conference, and they said, Chris, why don't you have a look at air freight, perishable air freight?
Okay.
Because anyone that can solve the perishable air freight dilemma, where nearly 25 to 30% of all fresh produce coming out of Thailand was being lost.
It's a lot.
And not only lost at destination, the farmers were responsible for that loss.
Right.
They paid air freight costs on top of the produce that was already so destined that comes to off be thrown. The that was already
farm gate price as well.
Yep.
Right.
And the particularly the corn industry was in free fall. The corn industry is about to be lost. When I started kicking around the agro value chain space, I saw opportunities there to not only remove polystyrene, the amount of polystyrene being used and being exported was phenomenally, it was a phenomenal environmental issue because polystyrene, you can't do anything with it at a destination. It was reducing the density that you could put in air freight, you know, like put polystyrene in, you can't use that space for fresh produce. And polystyrene doesn't make stuff cold.
Right.
You can only keeps cold stuff cold. It doesn't make stuff cold by putting warm produce in a polystyrene box. Okay. And that's what they thought. It was this magical material to keep stuff cold. So it was a whole series of end-to-end improvements that I got involved in. I put a year of my own time. I funded significant re-engineering projects over a year. I put all my savings into that. And out of that, we developed an end-to-end supply chain that allowed particularly the perishable fresh produce components, or fresh produce categories that was coming out of Thailand that were being abandoned by the international retailers, such as corn, particularly baby corn, was twice the price in the UK than Indian corn of identical farm gate costs. Right. The cost and losses were doubling the price of Thai corn in the UK markets. At the end of 12 months, we got that price down and we got it at parity with Indian corn by taking an end-to-end supply chain view, getting rid of polystyrene, doing pre-cooling, changing the packaging, and no one wanted to pay for anything. So that's why I had to do pro bono work for a year and set up and make my own investments to show that the innovative farmers could actually break through the market. And that's a separate case study in itself.
No, it's interesting. I mean, the biggest issue across the region has been impoverished farmers being kept poor. And it's very easy to blame here, blame there, blame that. But when it comes down to the logistical realities.
There were a whole lot of other things that were involved in there. Yeah. That's touching the transport pricing structure of the local freight forwarders.
Right.
Who controlled local air freight prices.
Okay.
Right. And they were financing farmers, basically. They had a grip on the farmers. That was what grip was. And then anyway, what I did was able to renegotiate with the regional airlines to change the pricing structures. So instead of I was getting retailers to buy the product in Thailand and invest in quality management costs. So the produce that was coming to them was much higher. The shelf life of product was much improved. We're able to take out polystyrene by doing pre-cooling at Bangkok Airport.
Right.
The whole thing's been running profitably for 16 years now, 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've extended that program to high-quality orchids. We have a cooling service at Bangkok Airport that allows Thailand to compete with Singapore in the orchid business.
Right.
With the pre-cooling.
Okay. Just recently, Soxapana, he's an honest, intellectual, straight shooter, Cambodian bureaucrat who I've known for many years. He said something most unusual in that ASEAN needs to reboot. And he covered many areas, which I took it to mean the issues that ASEAN's been confronted with, like Myanmar, South China Sea, but also transport, logistics. They launched the ASEAN Economic Community quite a few years ago now, and that was supposed to be the great telling of ASEAN economic unity. It hasn't really worked. How can you improve the supply chains across ASEAN, which is really what I think he was driving at, in that if you're going to have a more united region driven by economies of scale, what do you do? And given that the differences between many of these countries is fairly well known, we don't have to go there, but what would you do from a logistics perspective?
Cross-border tariff and customs processes harmonised to allow goods and services to be undertaken more easily between, you know, to make use of the economic corridors that are being developed.
Mm-hmm.
Currently being one of the large development organisations is asking me to help with the Thailand to Vietnam economic corridor, the B1 corridor, B2 corridor going from northeast Thailand into Hanoi.
Yep.
And there's a whole lot of infrastructure projects which development partners are looking at, improving roads and all this stuff. But it's the cross-border component, inland container depots, dry ports. These are ports without water. You know, they're using port concepts to allow the much more efficient transport of goods and services. That's really the other one. And things like left and right-hand vehicles, they can all be fixed up.
More countries are switching to either or anyway.
Yeah, either or, and they just move their prime movers over to the trailers. Areas that I've seen dramatically improve, particularly in Asia, well, it has been the export markets, which I'll talk about. We talked briefly about COVID, and COVID was for me an awakening of a new career for me.
I was going to ask if it was a godsend.
You could, apart from me packing a 2-day travel pack to travel to Vietnam, I was managing projects in Thailand and Vietnam when, in March, April 2020. I went to Vietnam with a 2-day travel pack and ended up being caught there 18 months because the borders closed after I went into voluntary quarantine. And I got caught there 18 months. The subject matter experts from all of these big companies can't travel. They can't travel into the countries anymore. They're locked in their regional headquarters. It was just like a Pandora's box for me.
Okay.
I was stuck in Vietnam. And there's one thing about the Vietnamese, you give them good ideas.
Oh, they know how to go.
And they go.
Yep.
And they're most remarkable people to work with, if you know how to work with them.
Yep.
You show them how, you give them ideas, you support them, and then you get out the way because they'll run over you. And then you got to jog up behind them every 6 or 18 months, and you provide new innovation targets for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like dealing with...
So some of the differences are interesting. I'm not sure.
Marathon runners, they're amazing to work with, yeah.
Right. I mean, one issue that has annoyed the Vietnamese, the whole point of the exercise is being wrongly portrayed and probably overblown, but that's the canal the Cambodians are planning to redig from Phnom Penh to Sihanoukville. And their argument, which I think they're quite right, is that it takes 3 to 4 weeks to get their goods through Saigon and to Japan, and they're stuck in Vietnam for 2 weeks. And now the plan to, which is going to be Chinese funded, but the plan to dig this old ditch out, it's a multi-billion dollar quest. But what's your take on?
Good luck to them.
Yep.
And good luck to Vietnam, because they're not exactly being constrained by the Cambodian thing. I think actually, to be honest, in a culture in Asia of canal-built economies. You know, Thailand was built on canals. And the Great Canal in China, you know, they could ship goods inland China up from
Saigon has canals as well.
Saigon has canals. So, good luck to them. It's just a pity that their history and the history has prevented it happening previously. But I think it's good luck. I was so fortunate to be in Vietnam during a period where the COVID restricted anyone else coming in. I was asked to have a look at agro-value chain opportunities, and I'd worked in Vietnam extensively with some amazing professional people who know, if they listen to this, they know who they are. The opportunity was that the Vietnamese are incredible agriculturalists, but they were being significantly constrained by the routes to market controlled by traders.
Yeah,
of the
central government, northern
origin. The Chinese fruit traders basically were bringing in fruit out of Vietnam through the borders, and all sorts of issues were resulting in massive food loss. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Jackfruit going into China, 65% of food loss due to bad handling and lack of cold chain and border manipulation of extreme bureaucracy. In trying to get stuff through the border. And on the other side of the border, they were looking forward to fruit being extensively discounted because they dehydrated fruit.
Right.
So high quality fruit didn't matter. On the other side of the border, they'd buy anything that was blocked at the border, and they'd put it through dehydration and chips. So there was no incentive to get stuff brought through. There was an opportunity presented itself to look at farmers in Haoyang province, which is probably the most impoverished area of Vietnam from an agricultural point of view, mainly because of salination of their rice fields and the sugar cane. 10% yield they were getting out of their crops due to salination and the interference with the Mekong the Mekong River scheme. It wasn't flushing the water through. The salt water was coming back flushing into agricultural land, and it was a real mess. Through a series of projects and program opportunities, I found myself with some extraordinarily talented Vietnamese agronomists, and we set up a fruit cooperative to consolidate agricultural land that had been converted from salted rice land and sugarcane into citrus, dragon fruit, and coconut farming, just 4 to 5 years old. And we're able to put in a modern logistics facility in Haoyang province and not rely on the farmers trying to get their produce to the markets in Saigon, or the Chinese traders who were manipulating the harvesting and the post-harvest logistics. We set up our own, bypassing the products where the cartels had strong grip over, which was durian and jackfruit. Mm. We found new products to work with. We set up world-class logistic facilities with container loading facilities, with proper boxes, and calling on a few old favours from my international retail mates. We got a few orders going. The quality was extremely high. We formed a cooperative under Vietnam Cooperatives regulatory guidance, and we had 250 farmers join the cooperative and invest all their time and effort into getting exceptionally high quality produce into containers and shipped overseas. We went through 3 or 4 major challenges during that time, and as an entrepreneur, you don't really connect often risk with reality.
Mm-hmm.
We went through the sanctions. We had sales of pink pomelo into Vladivostok, sent through to St. Petersburg. We had 10 containers there, and the Ukrainian issue arose where sanctions were placed on all produce being sold into Russia.
Right.
With 10 containers on the water with entrepreneurial investment put in.
Yours.
Yes, to an extent. And we didn't know whether we'd get paid with that when Putin put a cap of $10,000 a container on payment. He said, I will honour anything up to the value of $10,000 to stop the outflow of US dollars, right? So that was one. Subsequently, we had to pull back from Russia with sanctions. Then the second issue that happened, we had our first order of coconut, lime and pomelo into Turkey. The Suez Canal got blocked.
Right.
Our boat was our container with another $40,000 worth of entrepreneurial risk capital was stuck in behind it for 37 days. They turned off the refrigeration at 35 days.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too good, would it?
Well, it ended up being okay.
Okay.
We got paid. We thought we'd lost it. And the third thing with COVID caused a massive astronomical hike in the cost of cold chain reefer containers. We were committing sales into Europe, let's say for a 40-foot container, we're committing contracted sales based on a container cost of $2,000 a container, $2,000 or $3,000 a container. That cost escalated up to $12,000-$13,000 a container.
That's a lot.
With a committed selling price.
Right.
So we had to eat that.
Right.
And we just managed our
Sounds
way
like
through.
A futures contract gone wrong almost.
Well, we just pushed through with quality. Enormous dedication from these amazing cooperative farmers. The Biofruit Cooperative in Vietnam was just amazing. And that's where people's skin in the game gets you through. That's now an $8 million business.
Moving from Indochina and Southeast Asia out to the Pacific Islands, that's a big leap. I can only imagine that mainland Southeast Asia, it's overland. The transport, well, it's connected. In the islands, how is that working?
I've just spent a most amazing 5 months doing assessment work, finance opportunity
Which
assessment.
Which is where I do want to go next. But,
So something new. I got involved in Laos. I had 3 years in Laos after COVID because they needed help with cold chain and logistics and particularly in healthcare. And that's an area I had never been up until now, but I dedicated 2.5 years to putting innovation and actionable development partner projects in, as opposed to report writing. We had action outcomes, which my Development Bank was fully supportive of me. And in the last several projects, I got to write Green Climate Fund funding proposals for health, climate change adaptation. What's that mean? We're not talking about greenhouse gas stuff. We're talking about the effects of immediate changed climate.
Which is mattering more and more these days. We can all feel...
Look what's happened in the last 12 to 24 months.
Anyone who's lived in Southeast Asia knows.
That's real. That's not climate change in the future.
It's now.
That is extreme weather event disruption.
Sure. And people are vacating these areas now.
It's a crisis.
During the worst months.
Right. And I saw it in Laos as it was happening, unprecedented numbers of landslides. Now, you can talk about... the reason I don't want to talk about greenhouse gas, because man has overstretched its use of the environment. We're past a tipping point in many reasons. You know, you talk about sea level rise. Sea level rise is relative. When you spend decades pumping fresh water out of the centre of atolls, the sand collapses. And the land sinks relative to the sea level. When you know the results of man, you know they've dynamited coral reefs for fishing, and now and they've cut mangrove trees down. They've cut slash and burn mountainsides, you know, to plant tapioca. All of these things are in conjunction with definite increases in extreme weather, massive amounts of unprecedented rain, and every country has been affected
and
by
heat.
Massive
the April floods. May heat in Cambodia and Southeast Asia.
It's
extraordinary.
Now, I think it's all intermixed. Now, what does a healthcare facility in a remote community along the eastern border of Sekong Province with Vietnam, which we've spoken about before, Luke, where they can't get water for 6 months of the year? They can't do outreach because of the rains take out the bridges. They can't do maternity. They can't reach their community. So I got heavily involved in that. And I found heroes without capes or whatever you call them.
Yeah, I know what you
unsung,
mean.
Unsung heroes.
Hospital workers. Yeah, and
medics, volunteer workers that are so dedicated. And, you know, that's where my real calling has come out, that I think I can make a difference if I can use my collective experience not to do long-term projects. They are important. Many organisations are doing them much better than I can ever do. But to find point opportunities by going in the field, spending time in villages, doing outreach, living the life of the real problems and not writing about them, you know, remotely. And that's really what I've been doing over the last 2.5 years.
So I'd imagine the dynamics of what's required is going to change rapidly, and it will be country specific too. Each country has
its own individual
issues.
I thought I knew a lot
as
a result of my time in Laos until I had this amazing opportunity, which would probably be one of the plum jobs in climate change consulting, is to do needs assessment of 14 countries, of which the five Pacific Island countries I've just finished the last
which
5 months
were?
With has been Timor-Leste. It has problems with water. It has problems with floods. It's an impoverished country. And being an Australian, I learned about our history.
Yeah, the
our foreign policy history. And, you know, that's a discussion that I want to have with you later. But it was an awakening for me. And it was a motivator that, you know, for whatever the sins of the past, let's make a difference. So I was fully sponsored to look at funding proposals through the Green Climate Fund, potentially investment funding of $500 million. How do I spend it? If I had the chance to write a proposal, which was in my hand. That's when the awakening happened. I had access to all government ministries. I had access to vulnerable communities. I had access to development partner stakeholders and look at their capability and what would I recommend and what would be the best use of money that could be used properly, directed at immediate intervention called adaptation or resilience. Number one, cyclones. Number two, landslides, floods. Looking at healthcare facilities, improving educational facilities, building resilience in things like child protection. Children are vulnerable after extreme weather events. They get lost, they get displaced, they get pushed out of school. So all of these programs, I had an opportunity to put together a series of interventions that were common across Pacific Islands, which are not often looked at in a just manner when we're looking at mainland countries or mainland continents. So Timor, Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Vanuatu.
Okay.
So each one had its own needs. Each one had its own requirements. I did homestay in several of the countries and in several of the organizations. And I found projects which can be replicated, scalable, and sustainable with very focused use of funding. But the funding that my sponsors are providing have a gestation period of 2 years.
Right.
Sorry.
It's too long.
Too long for me. Yeah. It's good work, strategic work that I can do.
Mm-hmm.
What I have been able to do, and this is where my CSR component comes in, 50% of my consulting revenue goes, I feed back into...
You're reinvesting the money.
I reinvest.
In your own business.
So I build 2 weeks. Yep. I build international consulting rates, but I'll use that to fund extensions of stay, doing my own outreach, doing my own legitimate and sanctioned interaction through NGOs. Yep. That's where the NGOs come in, because they can legitimately provide me access. And I affiliate myself with 4 NGOs already. Things like mangrove nurseries. Everyone's into planting green and trees and all this stuff, but that's a much more important component. Mangrove nurseries are the source of income, not aid, income. Mm-hmm. And it's also the source of livelihoods for people that are usually displaced or remote, because their nurseries are growing mangrove saplings, right?
No, they're at the start of the food chain.
And NGOs are paying $4 to $5 each for a sapling to be planted on a coastal
It's a lot of mangroves.
Mangroves have a massive return on investment from the carbon carbon footprint component. Yeah. There's so many benefits of mangroves, but I'm not into mangroves. What I'm into is the nurseries that need families to grow the nurseries. Mm-hmm. They have children that are usually in these areas that don't have fresh water, they don't have sanitation, they don't have education, they don't have medical facilities.
Yep.
And they are the social services foundations that can be funded, that can allow these green and sustainable livelihood opportunities to scale up. But there are people who run those. I'm providing the foundations that allow those organizations to scale up. That's an example. Another one I worked in Vanuatu. I took the road less traveled and went into the markets, and I'm fortunate I can speak a bit of hybrid.
Your language skills are very good. I know that.
My top pisan and my Bislami are acceptable.
Okay.
Bislami is the Creole pigeon of Vanuatu. Solomon's I'm okay, because if you jumble through, the hovercraft full of eels with my pigeon in Solomon's, they can understand me. Yep. So I was quite surprised. I'd spent time in Papua New Guinea in the Air Force, so I was quite fluent years ago. I'd let it slip. But being able to reach out, go into a market, go up to a fisherman, look at the quality of his fish, find the ones that weren't being looked after very well, find the ones that were, talking with them, getting them to invite me back to the islands to have a look at how we can improve the quality of handling, look at the way they can survive cyclones, how they can improve the way they can preserve fruits that are in abundance for times where fruit gets destroyed in cyclones, for preservation, food preservation techniques.
I'd imagine that's becoming a bigger issue, in that many years ago I was part of a government tour up and down the Great Barrier Reef, and the damages that's been caused by acidification, climate change. But the real issue is that, and I'm trying to remember now the actual numbers, was that 100 years ago you might get a Category 8 cyclone once every 20 or 30 years. Now it takes a coral reef will grow perhaps an inch every year, and each time a Category 8 cyclone hits, it takes 2 inches off the coral reefs. Now that's acceptable when you're getting a Category 8 once every 20 or 30 years, but when you get 5 or 6 of them within a decade, that's doing untold damage that can't be replaced. And I'd imagine that that's having a similar impact on the islands and Vietnam, mainland and maritime Southeast Asia.
The meteorologist will correct you.
It's up to Cat 5.
Okay. Cat 5 is sort of like that's when all hell breaks loose. Right. You can actually categorize them all, but it's actually wind speed. And that's when everything goes, Cat 5s. And I was going into the islands that have been repeatedly hit by... Mm. I went right into coastal villages that are probably the most resilient of people that I've ever come across. Mm. You know, their traditional housing in Vanuatu, climate cyclone proof. Then they've lost the techniques to Western construction.
Right.
Roofs blow off, you know, schools get destroyed. But all of the original, and I've forgotten the actual
word for it.
There's
a lot to be said for bamboo construction.
Well, yeah, but also there are people that, fishermen, for example, that depend on their livelihood, have to pull their boats up offshore. They get 2 or 3 days' notice. Mm-hmm. They pull their boats way up on the hills and they still get flooded. They still get washed.
Right.
But it can be up to 8 weeks before those fishermen can get their boats back out to sea because they have to rebuild their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And when these islands are covered in fruit, you know, you've got pawpaw, mango, banana, breadfruit, they're in abundance, but the skill of fruit preservation is not in their DNA.
Right.
You go to northeast Thailand, you'll find every single village is drying mango and drying fruit, you know, the fruit. I bought that technique to one of the islands and the ladies are already drying fruit pulp. You see the fruit chips, right?
Mm.
That's their only concept of fruit, you know, dehydrated chips in the sun. But that licorice type consistency of mango pulp, they're delicious to eat. That's already, as a result of my time in Vanuatu, already being trialed.
Okay. Chris, well, we're starting to run out of time, but I've interviewed a lot of people over the years and I normally do finish off with what's your outlook for the next few years. I'd like to think that your outlook might be a little more optimistic than many other people I've spoken to.
It's just an adventure playground. For me, I just wish some of my colleagues that I know are far younger and more skilled and more, you know, they do tend to get caught up into this urban prison called retirement. You know, I'm 69 and I'm just feel like I'm starting my adventure. I would love to see Logisticians Without Borders, for example.
Yep.
I'd love to see we already have Engineers Without Borders coming in into those organizations. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of opportunities where if you've got something to give, there are people that would be always willing to accept you and welcome you in. If you've got an objective to take, you'll get shown the revolving door very quickly, you know.
Sure.
And my vision and my feeling for the future is that it's very positive. There are some very good programs taking place to help communities, particularly the ones that I've been working with, have roots to market, and they're getting a much more voice. Programs like yourself are creating much more awareness that there are alternate ways to introduce sustainable supply chains, sustainable, much more agile than institutional. I see Southeast Asia rapidly transforming the knowledge and the experience of locals. You know that also I've been working in Myanmar, where people are just absorbing everything you can give them, everything. And they're following you to the end of the earth to maximize how they can introduce change, resilient, sustainable and scalable change.
And on that note, Chris Caddo-Smith, it's been a wonderful nuts and bolts conversation.
Thanks, Luke.
All the way through. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. All right, there's a handshake.
Cheers, mate.
Okay, cheers.